camp, and this is your moment of clarity. Here's a novel statement. Here's something that's gonna blow your mind even more than when you heard Ricky Martin was gay. There are certain aspects of life that should not be for profit. Oh my God! A woman screams, a baby cries. Did he just say what I think he did? Profit should not affect certain areas of our existence. The decision as to whether someone gets a life-saving medical procedure should not be made by someone fearing for her job at a health insurance company. Someone who knows that if she authorizes the chemotherapy, it fucks her chances of getting promoted. Someone who will instead tell the cancer patient to try positive thinking, you know, or try one of those stress relievers, you know, the ones where you squeeze. So cancer lady dies with a squeezy toy in her hand, and the lady who told her no gets promoted up the ladder where she can tell more people no because they had acne when they were 12. Profit should also not be involved in prisons and the caging of human beings and war and the blowing up of human beings and strippers. I think strippers should be free. Profiting from the destruction of lives, whether it's bombs or metal bars, is repulsive. When someone tells you they're a higher up in the military industrial complex or the prison industrial complex or the kidney transplant denying industrial complex, you should look at them with pity and sadness, like they just told you they steal televisions for a living or they write the monologue for the George Lopez show. You should offer to help them find legitimate work selling ice cream or painting fences or spraying the tanner on Mitt Romney's face. You know, people love to say no one likes war as a cop-out when they don't want to argue with you about the moral implications, but it's not completely true. Some people make immense amounts of money from war. The heads of Boeing and KBR and Exxon and Otto's Opium Emporium have made insane amounts of money and likely built Scrooge McDuck-style gold coin swimming pools. Same goes for putting people in prison. Same goes for telling someone who needs a pacemaker that he should try jumping jacks instead. People are getting rich off of the greatest tragedies in our society, and the free market ass-face killers would have you believe that this is appropriate, because then companies will build the best prisons and the best bombs. And that's why unfettered capitalism rocks out with its cock out. And they will. They will build the best prisons and the best bombs, and they'll want to use them a lot. Like a lot. Like all the fucking time on as many people as possible, because the free market is free from moral qualms. It's free from having to give a flying shit about whether donating heavily to a politician who will push through draconian drug laws in order to fill up those for-profit prisons is a bad thing to do. Point is, don't ever think someone else is going to stand up to stop a war. They want as many wars as they can get their hands on because they added a gold coin hot tub next to the swimming pool. And those are the guys deciding other people should be locked up in prison? To catch a predator should go after those assholes. These people are preying on our friends and family. They're denying medical treatment to make a buck, locking people up to make a buck, blowing people up to make a fucking buck. Catch those predators on live TV and enjoy the ratings bonanza, okay? The only problem is that Chris Hansen would have to film one episode every 7 seconds because those predators are countless. Pedophiles are small potatoes. You tell me, which is morally worse, a man who tries to get with a 15-year-old girl or a man who sees dollar signs in his eyes as he denies the treatment of a 5-year-old girl with leukemia? You may still believe the pedophile is more morally repulsive, but all I'm saying is, it's a close call. It's a really close call. And one of those two guys is doing something illegal. Anyway, that's your moment of clarity, and I'm Lee Camp. Get more at leecamp.net. By the way, I'm saying no so far to advertising on Moment of Clarity. So in its place, please donate what you think this episode was worth at leecamp.net.
That was Lee Camp. You too can get in on for-profit tragedy. And this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast episode number 120. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is an interview with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, titled Rupert Murdoch's Callous Disregard, and is being released on Wednesday, July 27, 2011, My interview with Andrew was recorded on July 26, 2011. I said I'd have today's guest on more than a year ago. For whatever reason, the interview slipped through the cracks. Recent events in the media have brought him to the forefront once again, and I'm talking about Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Andrew Wakefield, MBBS, FRCS, FRC Path, is an academic gastroenterologist. He received his medical degree from St. Mary's Hospital Medical School, part of the University of London, in 1981, one of the third generation of his family to have studied medicine at the teaching hospital. He pursued a career in gastrointestinal surgery with a particular interest in inflammatory bowel disease. He qualified as Fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons in 1985, and in 1996 was awarded the Wellcome Trust Traveling Fellowship to study small intestinal transplantation in Toronto, Canada. He was made a Fellow of the Royal College of Pathologists in 2001. He has published over 130 original scientific articles, book chapters, and invited scientific commentaries. In the pursuit of possible links between childhood vaccines, intestinal inflammation, and neurologic injury in children, Dr. Wakefield lost his job to the Department of Medicine at London's Royal Free Hospital, his country, his career, and his medical license. He is married to Carmel, a physician and classical radio presenter. He has four children, James, Sam, Imogen, and Corin. And donations. This show is dedicated to Carlos, Cheyenne, Michael, Arthur, Jason, Kaylee, Jeremy, Thomas, Bew, John, Samuel, and Aaron. And this episode is dedicated to all of you. We really couldn't do it without you. And the widget for the new computer equipment is still up on the front page of the Gnostic Media website. Your contributions are greatly appreciated, and we've reached about 65% of our fundraising goal, thanks to all of you. And Thursday night before last, we had a full system failure. It took nearly a week to get everything up and running again. There's still equipment that we need for backing up data, as well as a backup computer system and a few other things. But nearly everything that's come in for new computer donations was spent as it came in, so we greatly appreciate all of your help. And it was just luck to have the donation widget up on the website just days before the failure. And we extended the length of time for the donations on the widget, so hopefully we're able to reach the goal and get all of the equipment we need. This show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or the audio archives, She Who Remembers archives, etc., you help to continue this programming. And, of course, we ask that you stop spending your money every month to the cable media, paying them to lie to you every month, month in and month out, or every day for that matter, and instead invest in your and everyone else's edification by supporting shows like this and upcoming shows. I know I keep saying that I will have Paul Churchland from UC San Diego on to discuss his book, The Engine of Reason and the Seat of the Soul. And that is still in the works, and I apologize for yet another delay caused by, of course, the computer failure. And I also felt that Dr. Andrew Wakefield's events in the media with Rupert Murdoch, etc., were pertinent to have on right away. Let's see. So upcoming shows, of course, Paul Churchland, Dodd Sutton, Derek Murphy, Miguel Connor, Peter Gorman. And once again, support this unprogrammed by going to the Gnostic Media website and ordering the books, DVDs, the She Who Remembers archives, a t-shirt, a download membership, etc. We greatly appreciate your support. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogrammed are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. The website, www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com. And you can contact me directly through the contact form on the website or at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here is the long-awaited explosive interview with Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Enjoy. All right, Dr. Wakefield, how are you today?
Extremely well, thank you. And great pleasure to be with you.
And I'm very excited to have you on the show, especially with all of the latest that's been in the media about you and your work, and not to mention I've read your book, and it's great work. Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself, your background, specialization, where you studied, practiced, that sort of thing?
Certainly. I'm a mainstream academic gastroenterologist. I trained at St. Mary's Hospital in London, starting in 1976, qualified in 1981, and pursued a career in gastrointestinal surgery. And my particular interests were Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, two sort of epidemic diseases of the latter half of the last century. And I went to study small bowel transplantation in Canada on a fellowship. It was a fascinating subject, although it was of use to a handful of people worldwide, but it did lead to some discoveries that got me further into the mechanism and causes of Crohn's disease. And at that stage, I left operative surgery and went into research, where I have been ever since, and started working on the field of autism, somewhat unusually, in 1995 onwards.
Is your book banned in the UK?
No, it wasn't banned. The publisher in the US sought out a collaborative publisher in the UK, and the collaborative publisher in the UK said, that's fine, you know, give us £100,000 to get a legal opinion, and we'll consider it. And that didn't seem like a terribly good investment, on the basis that people could get the book on Amazon anyway. So we didn't pursue that. But it wasn't for sale, for example, in the high street shops in the UK.
Yeah, I noticed on the inside the cover page, or inside the title page of the book, it says not for sale in the UK.
Yes, that can lead to the impression that it's been banned somehow by the government, which paradoxically makes it more attractive to people to read. You know, but no, it was they didn't manage to get their hands on that, although I'm sure they'd like to have done.
Would you please tell us what exactly is the MMR vaccine?
The MMR vaccine is a combined vaccine of three live viruses that have been isolated originally from people with the infection, say a child with measles, and then injected into cells in culture in a laboratory and grown through various numbers of what we call passages, and then injected back into susceptible individuals to see whether they develop full-blown measles or modified measles. And that's called attenuation. It's a misnomer that they're not attenuated. You merely modify the virus and the disease it causes. So you take these three distinct viruses, measles, mumps, and rubella, and you put them into the same shot. They're put into the same shot, which is obviously a most unusual combination in terms of human evolutionary biology. So that, in essence, is the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and it's in widespread use now throughout the world.
And how did you become interested in studying the correlations between autism and the MMR vaccine?
Well, the work really started when we looked at Crohn's disease and identified a mechanism in Crohn's disease that suggested it was caused by an infectious agent, possibly a virus, causing damage to blood vessels. Now, what's interesting about measles is that's what measles can do in the intestine. So I started looking at measles, and we found some preliminary evidence of measles linked to Crohn's disease. And the question was, why has Crohn's suddenly appeared in children in the mid-60s? Before that, it was unheard of children, and gone up dramatically when they're no longer being exposed to measles. Is it possible that the modification that has taken place in the vaccine has led to a greater risk? And we published a paper in The Lancet suggesting that there was an increased risk of inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's or colitis, following the vaccine compared with natural measles. And on the back of that, I started getting a series of calls from parents, starting, I think, in May the 17th, 1995, started getting calls from parents saying my child was perfectly normal, they were developing normally, they had speech and language that were coming on, they were potty trained, they were interacting with their brothers and sisters, and then they had their MMR vaccine. Often there was a seizure or a prolonged fever, and after that, the child was never the same again. They lost their speech, their language, they slid downhill, they lost their social interaction, they appeared to be in a world of their own. The parents would say it was like as though the lights had gone off in his eyes. And the child was eventually diagnosed with autism, or a regressive autism. And I knew nothing.
And most medical professionals would just typically dismiss the parents if they said it was right after a vaccine. Is that correct?
Well, that sadly is what happened. And so that the parents were told that they were just looking for an excuse. But the point that I would make is that if the child had undergone a similar regression following chickenpox, they'd had a seizure on day two or three and a high fever, and then gone downhill, people would have been extremely concerned about the link between chickenpox and that autistic regression. But because it was a vaccine, it seemed that there was a mental block in the medical profession. They simply did not want to hear of the possibility that a vaccine could cause autism.
In your book, you repeat that your theory is not proved. Would you tell exactly what you think the correlation between the vaccine and autism might be?
Well, at the time that we did the work, it was merely an association reported by the parents, but that makes it extremely important. That doesn't make it something that can be dismissed or labeled as coincidental. It makes it an extremely important clue that needs to be pursued, and I believe that the clue has borne out. I believe that parents are absolutely right. We know that measles and measles-containing vaccines can cause brain inflammation and brain damage. We know they can cause seizures. We know they can cause permanent brain injury. What if part of the spectrum of that brain injury were autistic regression? Now, this has really come to light in just the last few months when a paper was published out of Pace Law School in New York in the United States, where they had looked at those cases in the National Vaccine Injury Compensation System in the US that had been settled by the government. These are cases where the damage was acknowledged to have been caused by the vaccine. And when they did a preliminary analysis of those cases and followed up the children, they found at least 83 children who had developed autism as part of the neurological injury that had been caused by their vaccine. So those cases had been settled by the government, and this included MMR. Those cases had been settled by the government from the beginning of this program, from the late 80s, early 90s, long before I came on the scene and published in 1998. The government of the United States of America was settling cases where the outcome of the vaccine damage was autism, and yet denying that this link exists. And that
how many cases did they settle, do you know?
Well, they settled about 2,500 cases in all. The authors were able to get access initially to a limited number of cases, and now they are demanding of Congress that the remaining children in that cohort of 2,500 children are investigated similarly.
What is the strongest evidence of the correlation between the, you said, high fever, brain damage? What is the strongest evidence that you have that actually connects autism to the MMR vaccine specifically?
Well, one of the most interesting observations, and the reason that I came into this as a gastroenterologist, is that these children had intractable gastrointestinal problems. The parents had been saying to the doctors for years, my kid has got diarrhea, they're going 10 times a day. The doctor would say it's toddler diarrhea, and they would say, well, he's 7 years old. So that didn't make sense. And they had pain. They were clearly in pain, but couldn't articulate that pain. They would bang their head against a wall. When we scoped these children, as they should have been scoped long before, we found that they had a bowel disease, an inflammatory bowel disease, a form of mild to moderate colitis. Now, this is extremely important because it gives us a demonstrable injury that is associated with this syndrome, the regressive autism and the bowel disease, and we believe they're linked. Now, coming back to the strongest evidence, one of the questions we asked is there a systematic difference in the severity of the bowel disease between the children who've received one dose of MMR vaccine and those who have received two doses. And this is called this would be a rechallenge effect. So if I give you a drug, for example, and you develop a rash, well, that could be coincidence. But if I give you that same drug 5 years later and you develop the same rash, or your rash gets worse, then that is evidence of causation. And it's recognized in the courts and by the Institute of Medicine as being some of the most powerful evidence of causation. So in the UK, we did a study asking that very question: is the bowel disease worse in those children who have developed autism following MMR for those children who've had two shots compared with one? And the answer is yes. The bowel disease is systematically worse. And that is not something the parents can influence or bias. And it was done in a systematic way so that the person scoring the biopsies did not know whether they came from a child who'd had one or two shots. So that, to me, is some of the most compelling evidence of causation.
And there were some other symptoms as well that the children showed. Could you talk about the symptoms?
In addition to the gastrointestinal symptoms, some of the common things they would have are, it was ataxia. They would become unsteady, clumsy. They could eat with a utensil, and now they no longer could do that. They used to be able to walk, or they were cruising around the furniture. Now they stopped and they sat down. They started bumping into furniture. So the parents noticed they couldn't catch anymore. Now this is very, very important, because ataxia, clumsiness, unsteadiness, gait abnormalities are described as a consequence of MMR vaccine injury. And this is work that was done by Dr. Plesner in Denmark, and subsequently confirmed in a follow-up paper by Dr. Plesner. So here we have children manifesting another known or recognized complication of an MMR vaccine. And interestingly, Jan, this complication of ataxia had not been seen with the single vaccine, the single measles vaccine. It seemed to be a novel complication associated with the triple vaccine specifically.
Now, it was a specific type of the MMR vaccine that you were worried about. What was it called? The poly...
The Pluserix vaccine?
Yes, that's it. But you weren't against other types of measles vaccines, et cetera, were you? Or was it just that specific one?
Well, it wasn't a question really at that stage of being for or against. It was merely asking the question, is there a particular problem with this vaccine? And the Pluserix vaccine is a very, very important lesson to have learned, because in the US, the MMR had been used for some years. It was the Merck vaccine, called initially MMR1, then MMR2. And this country never had the Pluserix vaccine. The Pluserix vaccine was made by SmithKline Beecham. It was used in countries like Canada, Australia, and the UK. And it was dangerous. It was dangerous. The mumps component of the vaccine caused meningitis in a good number of children, and was associated with some permanent injury. And it was withdrawn. Now, the important thing about this vaccine, and which really highlights the attitude of the UK regulators to vaccine safety issues, is that the same month that this vaccine was withdrawn in Canada for safety reasons, because it was causing meningitis, it was licensed in the UK under a different name. The exact same vaccine, they changed the name and licensed it despite being told that they should not do so because it was associated with an unacceptable level of complication. And 4 years later, exactly as had happened in Canada, it had to be withdrawn in the UK because it was producing meningitis and doing so at a rate that was 100 times that they had predicted by their surveillance mechanisms.
And in your book, you talk about a lot of these children that were affected by this bad MMR vaccine. They would have all sorts of stomach problems where they would rock back and forth over the edge of furniture and things like that, trying to settle their stomach. And this would often be largely ignored as part of autism.
That's absolutely right. What this presented us with was a completely different presentation of gastrointestinal problems in children, children who could not, in this instance, communicate. They'd lost the power of speech, they'd lost the ability to articulate their problems, and they would be living in constant pain sometimes. And the behavior was much worse, understandably, when they were in pain. And people need to try and imagine what it's like living with a terrible colic day in, day out, and not being able to tell anyone about it. And these children would, anything, as you say, from leaning over the edge of furniture for hours on end to put pressure on their abdomen to relieve the pain, right the way through to beating their head against a wall or biting themselves, mutilating themselves to try and distract the pain elsewhere. And it's a great, great tragedy. And when we realized this, we treated the bowel disease with standard anti-inflammatory medication that we would use for Crohn's or colitis, put the children on special diets, and these symptoms got better. The children calmed down, their pain went away, their diarrhea went away, they started sleeping at night, and their well-being improved dramatically, and that was enormously reassuring.
Are there other vaccines that have had this same type of safety issue?
Yes. Sadly, the more I've gone into this, the greater has become the awareness of major problems with other vaccines. And again, this did not start as an anti-vaccine argument at all. It started, as medicine should, from the basis of the parental story, what happened to your child. But soon after we became involved, a group of parents in the US, based upon disclosures from vaccine regulators, realized that children were getting doses of mercury as a preservative in many vaccines, not the MMR, but many of the other vaccines, way in excess of the Environmental Protection Agency guidelines on toxicity for adults, let alone children. Simply, the regulators had failed to add up the cumulative dose of mercury that the children were getting. Now, mercury is a very, very powerful toxin. I think it was said by Dr. Salisbury, one of the regulators in the UK, that it is only damaging to the brain in industrial quantities. I have no idea what he means by that. It is damaging to the brain in minute quantities. And these children were getting a lot, starting at day one with the hepatitis B vaccine, day one of life, a policy that had never, ever been put to rigorous testing for safety. So there was another factor playing in, not just MMR, not just a live viral vaccine, but now a preservative that should never have been in the childhood vaccines, and most certainly should never have been given in the cumulative doses that it was being given.
Why was it in the vaccine?
Well, it was in the vaccine ostensibly as a preservative. It's not a very good preservative, but when you use a multi-dose vial, let's say, you know, you go into the doctor's office and he's going to line up 20 children and give them a shot. Well, you use a multi-dose vial, and you have to have a preservative, because every time you reintroduce a needle into the rubber bung at the top, then you potentially introduce bacteria. And so the preservative was in there. However, there is one more clandestine reason that it's in there, and that is that it promotes the immune response. It aggravates the immune response to produce antibodies. And in fact, it's likely that the vaccine might not have worked without that, what we call an adjuvant or boosting or helping effect. The other problem, of course, is that it's not just mercury in there. Now, many of these vaccines contain aluminum. Aluminum is a known toxin to the brain. And
isn't it connected with Alzheimer's and things like that?
There is substantial evidence that it is associated with neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, yes. And so why are we injecting this? If there is even a shadow of a doubt, why are we injecting it into children? So we're putting not just mercury in, but aluminum and a host of other things, compounded by giving live viral vaccines without any safety studies of the cumulative or synergistic impacts of those agents at all.
Now, I understood that California or possibly the United States had passed a law that the, what is it called, thimerosal or thimerosal, that's the mercury?
Thimerosal.
thimerosal, that it's no longer permitted in vaccines in California. Is that correct?
I think certain some states have. And what initially came about is parents protested. There were government hearings, and under Dan Burton from Indiana, and whose own son grandson had regressed after a large number of vaccines into autism, and there was a recommendation, not a law, but at the first instance there was a recommendation to remove it. And so it was phased out gradually. It should have been removed immediately. In fact, it should never have been there in the first place. But certain states have enacted laws to have it removed. But those laws, unfortunately, do permit thimerosal to be in there under certain circumstances. For example, if there's an epidemic or bioterrorist threat that means they have to vaccinate a lot of people in a short space of time. And of course, it's found its way into the influenza vaccines given to young children and to pregnant mothers. So far from being removed from vaccines, it is still there.
All right. Well, how can they, is there an agent out there that can act as this antagonist or whatever you called it for the immune system and still not be as dangerous as mercury or aluminum?
It's a very good question, Jan. It acts as a promoter, an agonist, if anything. It's something
agonist.
That stimulates the immune system further. Is there anything else out there that would work? Well, one of the potential candidates that you may have heard of is a substance called squalene, which is a fatty, an oily-like substance, which was used, I believe, in the anthrax vaccine given to Gulf War soldiers. And a very interesting book was written on that, called Vaccine A by Gary Matsumoto, who used to be an anchor for major news networks some years ago, a very eminent journalist who, having written this book, found himself without a job. He drew attention to the dangers of squalene as an adjuvant. So is there anything out there that is safer? I don't know. It may be that there is something that's commercially sensitive, that's under production, that we don't know about. But at the moment, I do know that we are stuck, unfortunately, with this extremely dubious aluminum adjuvant, which I really don't think should be there at all.
So you either get mercury or aluminum or this other thing, or you don't use vaccines at all. So there is no, what you're saying that to me, it sounds like, is that there is no truly quote unquote safe vaccine in that case.
Well, I think safety is something that a vaccine has to earn. It is not something that is awarded by right. And that comes about through adequate safety testing. That is, before it's put into children, in animal models, for example, and then in testing in healthy pediatric populations, testing in the pediatric population more broadly, and then widespread use with adequate follow-up for adverse events. That has not happened for any vaccine that I know of. And so no vaccine has earned the label of safety, particularly when given in combination with other vaccines. For example, children now might receive 6 to 9 vaccines at the same visit. There have been no safety studies of that kind of policy.
Now, that's something that I understood. And when I was a child, they didn't administer any vaccines until I was 2 years old. And when my son was born, within, an hour or two of him being born, they came in and they wanted to give him a plethora of different vaccines all in one, and we refused, and they called Child Protective Services to interview us, that we were going to be, or you know, that I was going to be endangering the child because we didn't want the vaccinations done. And I told them and the doctor that if they could provide one single peer-reviewed study that showed that the vaccines were safe in children under the age of 2, that I would consider it. And that was when they called the CPS.
Well, it should be an extraordinary story. Sadly, it's not. The vaccine that's given on day one of life to American children is the hepatitis B vaccine. And this is one of the most bizarre and potentially one of the most dangerous policies that I am aware of. Neil Halsey, who was one of the senior architects of the American vaccination program for children, was asked at a public meeting in Louisiana, why do you give a vaccine that is intended for people who are sexually promiscuous or intravenous drug abusers, hepatitis B vaccine, why do you give that to infants on the first day of life?
Right. I mean, they wouldn't even be in a category of risk until they were at least 14 to 16 years old.
Correct. And his answer to those parents was, because we can. That is the scientific rationale that is attached to that. Now, the reason they do it, Jan, is for this, because they have found out, retrospectively, that if they start vaccinating on day one, parents are more likely to comply with the rest of the vaccine schedule. That's not safe. That doesn't make it safe. That doesn't make it merited. That's some post hoc observation that has nothing whatsoever to do with safety. And I can find, and I have researched this, absolutely no safety studies of administering that vaccine to infants on day one of life. I think it is bizarre and it is dangerous. And we did a study in primates looking at this, and we found that in those primates that had been given the infant hepatitis B vaccine containing thimerosal on the first day of life compared with those who did not get that vaccine but got saline as a placebo, then there was brain damage that manifests as delayed acquisition of key reflexes, feeding reflexes, in those animals. And that is very, very worrying. And the idea that this has never been subjected to safety testing, but you can have CPS called on you and threatened because you do not want your child vaccinating, is utterly bizarre. You did exactly the right thing, saying, show me one peer-reviewed study that says this is okay. And there is not one. There is not one.
Right. And the doctor was absolutely furious when I said, show me a study. I'm like, you know, I know there isn't one. I've looked. If you can show me a study, we'll move forward. But, you know, one thing that my son has received a few vaccines. Like a couple of years ago, we went down to Peru and he was given the polio vaccine and I think one other one before we went, just before his third birthday. So, you know, it seems to me that if you use them and not a whole bunch of them all at once and use them if you're going into an area where they might be at risk, such as if you decide you're going to be an HIV drug user or homosexual, get the hepatitis B vaccine, right?
Yeah, there are clearly high-risk groups that would merit exposure to the vaccine, but making it a universal policy for all healthy children whose mothers are not infected and therefore are not going to get infected themselves for many, many years, if at all, is absolutely unacceptable. And the doctor's anger is, I'm afraid, a reflection of his ignorance and his arrogance. That because he's confronted with a situation where a parent dares to question his judgment, when his judgment is based on no scientific evidence at all, then his only response is to lose his temper and call Child Protective Services. And that is a very, very sorry state for medicine to have found itself in.
All right, let's get back to your story. Who is Professor Zuckerman and what did he have to do with this whole fiasco that you find yourself in today?
Well, Professor Zuckerman was my dean at the Royal Free. He was an expert in hepatitis B virus. He was on the World Health Organization for hepatitis B virus. He owned certain patents in respect of hepatitis B vaccine. And he considered himself to be a very eminent doctor. In fact, that's how he described himself, as the world's leading clinical virologist. So a modest understatement of his achievements. But Professor Zuckerman was a conflicted character because he, on the one hand, as dean, was responsible for upholding academic freedom. That is the right of doctors and scientists to investigate, to ask valid scientific questions such as, are vaccines safe? Do vaccines cause autism? And not to interfere with that because it might be against public policy. Now, what happened to Zuckerman is at some stage, early in the proceedings, I was contacted by lawyers and I agreed to act as an expert in the MMR or the pending MMR litigation in the UK? Was there a case that could be made against this vaccine in causing bowel disease and autism? And I felt morally obliged to do so because there is no future for these children beyond their parents becoming infirm or dying. There is no facility for them. No one will look after them. No one cared. And there were there was no housing, no accommodation, no jobs. These children were going to become young adults who died on the street. So something had to be done. Somebody had to take responsibility for this epidemic. And I agreed to get involved. Well, soon after that, the British government made contact with the dean and told him that he had to stop my valid vaccine safety research. And so he tried to do so. And here was his conflict. On the one hand, he's got these people telling him to stop it. On the other hand, he's trying to protect academic freedom. And so in doing this, he wrote to the British Medical Association's Ethics Committee, their institutional review board, asking if it was ethical for me to do research that might put the government in the firing line. Now, as far as I was concerned, it wasn't the government. It was, in fact, the drug company that was in the firing line. But little did I know. Now, what happened was the British Medical Journal's Ethics Committee wrote back to him saying, actually, Professor Zuckerman, it would be unethical not to do this work. And if it causes the government to be sued or your institution to be embarrassed, well, that's just too bad. That is not a sound moral basis for not doing the work. So Professor Zuckerman buried that response, and I never saw it for many, many years. And he did stop the work. He effectively did stop it. I only learned years later that, in fact, it was the government that was destined to be sued, because, in fact, unknown to anyone but the government themselves and the drug industry, they had indemnified SmithKline Beecham for the damage caused by that MMR vaccine that produced meningitis in children. They had gone ahead and said, we will pick up the tab for this, because SmithKline Beecham were unhappy, it appears, to sell that vaccine knowing it could cause harm. They were worried about their liability. But the government wanted it for whatever reason. It was cheaper. SmithKline Beecham were a UK manufacturer. Give it to the home team. Who knows what? Nonetheless, it was the government that was on the hook. They were due to be sued because they were the ones responsible. I did not know that, but they had to stop the work for that reason, and that's why they had to silence me. So Zuckerman, conflicted from the very beginning, eventually sided with the government and did his very best to stop the work.
Who was George?
George is a key figure in all of this. Not a brave man, I'm afraid. George was the whistleblower. George was a doctor who was recruited from Canada, where he had worked with the Pluserix vaccine. He had been part of the monitoring of the vaccine that recognized it was unsafe, and it had been withdrawn. He was asked to come and advise the UK regulators on the introduction of this vaccine. And he said, don't do it. Do not do it. It is not safe. They ignored him and they went ahead anyway. And some years later, when I became involved in the litigation, George made contact through the lawyers. And we, that is the lawyers and I, went to meet with George on one Sunday afternoon in the far north of England on a train station. It was like something out of John le Carré's spy novels. And George would only refer to himself as George initially. It soon turned out that he was, in fact, the senior medical officer, and he was there to blow the cover on what had happened with that dangerous Urabi vaccine and the sort of, as he described it, almost fascist atmosphere that pervaded public health at the time. And he said, these people will stop at nothing to get what they want. And so George features in the book and was one of the main reasons that at the time I decided I had to commit to this morally and professionally, because of the various abuses, as I saw it and he saw it, that had been perpetrated against the children.
Short segue. Do you know Dr. Peter Duisberg?
I have read some of his work, and I've heard it talked about at various meetings, yes.
You know, I interviewed him about a year ago on my show, and he like you, presents a very solid case. And I used to know Dr. Kerry Mullis, who invented PCR DNA testing, and he won the Nobel Prize for that. And he had also come out against it. The guy, I forget his name, Davis or David something, he came out. He's the guy that invented the protease inhibitors in AZT. And he, all of these characters that were the core foundation of AIDS research came out against AIDS cause or HIV causing AIDS. And all of their stuff has been covered up and put down just as yours. And it seems to me that there is a recurring theme here that you may want to consider talking directly with Duesberg.
Yeah, and I'd be fascinated to do so. I dissent is essential in science. When you reach consensus, then you know you're wrong.
Go ahead.
Please go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, last year, in fact, right after I had had Dr. Duesberg on my show, I had emailed you and him and CC'd the both of you together and asked if you two would be interested in doing a show together, and I ended up not hearing back from either of you.
I apologize sincerely. I don't remember getting that, but I may well have been tied up with the General Medical Council in the UK at the time, which tended to take every night and every day for a long, long time. So that may have been the reason. So my apologies.
Oh, no problem. What companies were behind the cover-up with Plusrix? You said it was GlaxoSmithKline?
Yes, there were two companies using this vaccine. GlaxoSmithKline and Aventis Pasteuria were using what is called the Urabi mump strain, the Urabi strain that was responsible for the meningitis.
Let's get into some fun stuff here. Let's talk about your trial.
Yes, the hearing, the General Medical Council hearing, the GMC is there as a body of doctors and lay people, ostensibly to protect patients and regulate doctors. And I was very happy to go forward and present our case to the General Medical Council. I did so with two co-defendants, co-authors of the Lancet paper, eminent pediatric gastroenterologists. In fact, John Walker Smith was the founding father of pediatric gastroenterology, a man with an impeccable and an unimpeachable career who spent his whole life caring for children. The case that was put forward by our lawyers was very, very solid. We were able to provide answers for everything. The case that the General Medical Council put forward, there was one that was put to them by Brian Deer, the journalist, and that is that we did not have ethical approval for the study. Documents were produced during the study showing clear evidence that we had ethical approval for what we did, and they were ignored. It was extraordinary. They were just ignored. It turns out that Brian Deer had these documents in his possession at the time that he filed his complaint, but he did not disclose them. And there are those who might suggest that that was an attempt to pervert the course of justice. So there was clear ethical approval for the work we did. The children were seen and investigated by the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologists. A novel disease was discovered and treated in these children, and they got better as a consequence. And there were absolutely no complaints from any of the hundreds of parents whose children we saw at the Royal Free. However, and as my lawyers said at the end, and the other lawyers said, the fix was in. The fix was in. The outcome was determined from the get-go, in our opinion, and whatever happened, whatever we said, had no bearing on that outcome. And in order to protect vaccine policy, in order to protect the government, in order to crush dissent, then we were found guilty. And I have no problem, and the book obviously covers that in some detail.
Yeah, obviously nobody has shut you down for slander.
No, they haven't. And one of the things about defamation is that it's about discovery. That if you sue me for defamation or I sue you, then we get discovery of each other's documents, emails. They do not want discovery. They desperately want to avoid discovery.
So in a sense, you're baiting them to see if, you know, because, I mean, you really name names and lay everything out there in your book. So you're really baiting them to draw them out.
This book is highly embarrassing to so many people because the facts are there. The facts, the documented facts are there. Where opinion is expressed, it is expressed as precisely that opinion, but I have heard nothing, nothing from Richard Horton from The Lancet, nothing from Brian Deere, nothing from Zuckerman, not a word. Why? Because it's highly embarrassing to all of them.
All right. Well, let's get on to Dr. Richard Horton at The Lancet. Is there anything going on right now to yank his medical license and force him to resign from The Lancet? Because he's obviously, it seems to me, and I'm going to put a caveat, seems there, that he has committed academic fraud.
Well, a complaint has been filed to the General Medical Council by an independent attorney against Dr. Horton for exactly exactly the basis that you describe. It's also been filed against Professor Zuckerman, against David Salisbury, the head of immunization in the UK, and others. So if the GMC has any teeth whatsoever, it will investigate those complaints and assess the evidence on its merits. My suspicion is they will want to bury it as fast as they possibly can. It may be difficult. It may be increasingly difficult because of what has happened in the UK more recently with the Murdoch Empire, and that is tied in directly to my own circumstances.
Well, let's get into that in a couple of minutes, if we may, or is that pertinent to how you describe the trial or at the GMC at this point?
No, we can certainly come to that a bit later.
Okay. Who could possibly trust The Lancet now with someone like Horton there after this fiasco? And I mean, you really laid out the details. You did your proper grammar, logic, and rhetoric in your book there, and you have... The arguments seem very tight and impenetrable, and not only that, but when you prove somebody wrong, you didn't just prove them wrong once. You often pulled up 3, 4, 5, 10 different instances of them being wrong. How could The Lancet possibly exist as a unbiased medical journal today, or would that be poisoning the well to suggest that Horton being there corrupts everything that The Lancet is about?
Well, in my opinion, he should not be there. He has shown himself, in my opinion, to be unfit to act as the editor of The Lancet. And he should have resigned. That won't happen. It won't happen because the medical infrastructure, the government, the industry in the UK do not want it to happen. They do not wish to give our side of the argument, my side of the argument, any credibility whatsoever, because to do so would raise questions in the mind of the public about the safety of vaccines. And to do that would then compromise vaccination policy and the profits of the pharmaceutical industry. So the best thing they can do, the thing that they've been doing at the moment, is to simply ignore it, hope it goes away, but not to ignore me, to take further steps to try and vilify, destroy me in order that my opinion and this book, for example, count for nothing.
Yeah, again, exactly what they did to Dr. Duisberg. How does autism compare with CDD?
With childhood development, disintegrative disorder? I think they're one and the same thing. I think that one of the biggest problems here, Jan, is that this disease fell into the hands of child psychiatrists. And if I have a bete noire in this thing, child psychiatry was the worst starting point for this disorder. Because in the absence of any ability to do anything about it or to take any notice of the systemic symptoms like bowel problems and to focus on the brain and how bad the mother is, how cold and indifferent she is, or how it must be genetic, then they lost their way. They lost their way from this being a hard organic disease. And this is one example. So autism, historically, classically, we were taught, started from the get-go. The child was never right. They never wanted to be picked up or held. They didn't nurse properly, or they never smiled, never made eye contact. And therefore, it was assumed to be something that started in the womb or was genetic. CDD, on the other hand, was identical to autism, except that it started after the age of 3, a purely arbitrary cutoff made up by psychiatrists. So a child was developing normally, and then suddenly they underwent profound autistic regression with loss of skills. But when they had developed their disease, they were indistinguishable from a child with autism. Now, therefore, is it not possible that, in fact, these are the same disorders with a different age of onset? One might be due to an insult in the womb, an infection in the womb. One might be due to an insult at the age of 3. It doesn't make them different disorders because they have a different age of onset. But they were classified differently because of that age of onset. And if you got autism before age 3, you had autism. And if you got it afterwards, you had CDD. Well, that was just nonsense. It was arbitrary. And then someone came along and described early onset childhood disintegrative disorder at the age of 1.5, of 2 years. And that threw the whole thing right out the window. So it makes no sense at all. And when you come to it from the perspective of a gastroenterologist and you look at this, you say, well, actually, it's much more likely that these are the same disorder with a different age of onset. And what they're telling us, what they're giving us, the clue here is telling us about what impacted that child at that particular time. Was there something that hit that child at the age of 3 that then caused them to go downhill? And what was that? And in many cases, I believe it may be the vaccine.
Other researchers, such as in Sweden, had found a similar link. Is that true?
The work done by the Swedes was in the early work with Anders Ekbom and others was in relation to Crohn's disease. And this was where we collaborated with them to show that mothers who had measles during pregnancy, for example, went on to develop children with Crohn's disease. But the people who had taken up the gauntlet of looking for bowel disease in autism around the world included people like Dr. Krigsman in New York, Dr. Gonzalez in Venezuela, Dr. Balzilla in Turin. And all of those investigators confirmed that in children in their respective countries, with autism, there was an associated bowel disease identical to that which we had described.
There were charges raised against you for disclosure, which I felt in your book you well refuted. Would you please discuss the charges against you?
Certainly. I was asked to and agreed to act as an expert witness in the litigation, the MMR litigation. The children who came to the Royal Free, most certainly the first 12, were not, to our knowledge, involved in any litigation at the time they were referred to Professor Walker Smith. The parents had asked for them to come to see him on the basis of the children being sick, their bowel symptoms, their aggressive autism. They were not involved in litigation. Now, it was known that I was involved in litigation in the national media at least a year before the Lancet paper was published. Richard Horton was informed by the lawyers that I was working with them at least a year in advance of publication. And, in the year in advance of publication. And there was no secret whatsoever. The requirements of the Lancet for disclosure at that time were entirely on the shoulders of the author of the paper himself. What would you consider to be a conflict? And I thought about this, and since those children were not involved in litigation, then it made no sense to me to disclose the fact of the litigation beyond what was already in the mainstream media or what was already known to Richard Horton. And I wrote to The Lancet shortly after publication when this issue was raised, and I brought this up again. And I said, I have agreed to act as an expert in the MMR litigation. And Richard Horton thought nothing of that at the time. And it passed for 6 years. 6 years later, when he was feeling the heat, that suddenly became an issue again. And what was applied to me by him and by the General Medical Council were not the rules as they were. In other words, it's up to you to decide what you think is a conflict. But the new rules, far more onerous, and that is what other people might perceive to be a possible conflict. In other words, you as the author have got to sit there and think, well, might someone else think this is a possible conflict? And if so, therefore I should declare it. Now, that's infinitely greater than, you know, the burden being upon the author himself.
Now, didn't Dr. Horton call you just hours before he went public saying that you had committed fraud in your research?
No. In fact, he called me just before he went public.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. Yeah. Didn't he call you? Yes.
No, he did call me, but he called me to tell me how impressed he was by my resolve and stoicism, and he didn't doubt my integrity at all. And I rather naively thought, well, you know, thank you for that. And I told my wife, and she threw up her hands in horror and said, oh, my God, something bad is about to happen. And she, of course, was right. And he went on to all the mainstream news outlets in the UK and denounced me and the work.
So first he calls you and says that he doesn't doubt your integrity, and then goes all over the media, says that you have no integrity. So, you know, logic requires that we remove contradictions, and that seems to be a blatant contradiction.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Let's get back to this character, Brian Deere, the journalist.
Yes. Brian Deere, where did he come from?
Where did he come from? He seems to have just set out to lambast you rather than allowing the evidence to stand for itself from the beginning.
Yes. How do we characterize Brian Deere? Brian Deere is a liar. Brian Deere is best characterized as a liar.
And that's not an ad hominem that you can't support. I think
absolutely.
For those out in the audience out there who think that's an ad hominem, read Dr. Wakefield's book, because he very well substantiates that Brian Deere is a liar.
Yes. And this is easily proven by simply his first encounter with the first mother that he interviewed at the very beginning of his investigations, when he entered the home of a distressed mother who was a very, very badly damaged child under a false name. He did so deliberately, by his own admission, in an effort to deceive her. That is a lie. Ergo, he is a liar. And that lie has continued since and has been exemplified most recently in a series of articles that he has published in the British Medical Journal, where he has blatantly accused me of scientific fraud. He has accused me of altering test results on children in order to create the impression that there is a link between MMR, bowel disease, and autism in these children. And that is demonstrably false. He knows it is not true. And unfortunately, he's drawn the British Medical Journal into his web of lies, because I believe they did not do their due diligence. They did not check their facts, and they have found themselves in an almighty mess.
Have you gone after Brian for defamation and slander?
Well, this is something that is certainly worthy of consideration. He has completely overreached and made himself into what is effectively low-hanging fruit. And it would be something well worth considering at this stage, defamation, because an end has to be put to this nonsense. You cannot have science and medicine being held hostage to this kind of barbarism where reputations are destroyed on a whim, where it takes one newspaper article to cause huge damage and 10 years or a lifetime to rein that damage back in. And he knows that, and he operates under those circumstances. And at least until recently, he operated under cover of the strength, the power of the Murdoch news empire and their relationships with the British government and with the pharmaceutical industry. And it seems, at least now, that those circumstances have changed and he may not be in quite the position he was before.
Well, you know, and I want to say two things here. I actually emailed Brian Deere over the weekend and asked him if he had any supporting evidence, because the onus of proof is on him to support his claims. And, of course, I got no reply whatsoever from him, so that was no surprise there. And also, so if he's under Rupert Murdoch's umbrella, has anybody followed the paper trail to see if or how much Rupert Murdoch is invested into the pharmaceutical companies that supplied these vaccines?
Well, it's interesting that one can draw a straight line between them. Rupert Murdoch's son, James Murdoch, who's in charge of running Rupert Murdoch's operations in the UK, was put on the board of GlaxoSmithKline, the manufacturer of MMR vaccine, as a
That really is a straight line.
Yeah, as a non-executive director, and with the aim, with the job description, it seems, to protect the public image of the pharmaceutical in that particular company, using, I imagine, the newspapers and news outlets at his disposal. And that is something that has more recently been called into question, because it clearly goes to the core of what has been happening to me. Protecting corporate interests through the use of the media, and thereby one imagines crushing dissent where one sees it from people such as myself. And Brian Deere there as an employee, albeit right, as a freelance journalist in this particular issue.
You know, it seems to me that if Brian Deere was a true journalist and had any integrity, that if he found these errors, that he should be the first to be standing up demanding the return for your medical license and a reinvestigation of your research and demanding that The Lancet republish your paper.
Yes, I think that given Mr. Deere's fragile ego, that is unlikely to happen.
Well, then he'll go down in history as such. And I guess we've already covered well enough how his story is based on lies. Or actually, did we cover enough of, did you want to cover some of his specific claims against you?
We could go on for hours about those. I think that there's a new book coming out, actually, Jan, and I'll send you a copy. It's a book, in fact, that was stimulated by my going on the book tour and ending up in Phoenix and hearing about a family of five children with autism who had been removed from their parents by Child Protective Services. And it was a horror story, not a horror story, and I decided that I would investigate it, and it just got worse and worse. And so I've written a book about it, and in that I go into the issue of Brian Deere and the impact of his disclosures and his lies, particularly on the population of children with whom we're dealing, you know, the autistic children. Many, many of them have not been investigated appropriately because of the damage done by him saying this was all a hoax. It wasn't. The bowel disease is real. These children could have been helped. They've not been. The vaccine has not been adequately investigated because he was able to put this story out there. So he's done immense damage, in my opinion. More of him will be discussed. Also, if people go to ageofautism.com and read a wonderful daily blog newspaper published by Dan Olmsted, he's doing a series of articles right now on Deere and the straight line between him and the Murdoch empire and the drug company. And those are well worth reading. They will emerge as a series of articles. And I think it will be an interesting time. And I think that Brian Deere is going to find himself in a very difficult position from here on.
Yeah, you know, it seems that, if anybody died from that, that in some way he should be brought up on murder charges if he, and provably so based on what you've presented so far, if he can be tied to the cause of death and the cause of these autisms, then it seems to me that he should be brought up on charges for all of this stuff.
Yes, I think it's an interesting approach. I suspect that it will be the argument will be a little too tenuous for a court to make a case. I've been in a similar situation, actually. I've been accused of deaths of children through making recommendation of being anti-vaccine. I'm not anti-vaccine. Indeed, I urge children should continue to be vaccinated with the single vaccines. My concern was about a specific vaccine, MMR, in the first instance, but not anti-vaccine at all. But that's
and thimerosal, or however that's pronounced as well.
That's right, and that's come along latterly, absolutely. This is a public relations exercise to say this man is anti-vaccine, he's responsible for children's deaths, and to therefore, in the minds of the public, silence any valid criticism of the vaccines that I might make. And it's purely a public relations exercise. It will fail. It'll fail because what we're dealing with is real. It's true. The parent's story is valid. The numbers are growing daily. This is a major worldwide tragedy. And despite the public relations exercise and all the mud that's been thrown at me, 89% of American parents put vaccine safety research as their number one medical priority, and over 50% believe that vaccines cause autism. So the public relations campaign has been expensive, extravagant, deceptive, and a failure.
Are you going to sue Murdoch?
You know, I could spend the rest of my life in litigation. I'd prefer not to. I'm much more of a creative person. I would like to do some good and create rather than just immerse myself.
Well, what if it could be used to something positive, where he would have to force, you know, where you could force him and his media outlets to do a retraction, a global retraction in your name, as since he's caused the damage and his puppet deer.
Well, I think if it would be a wonderful irony if he were. His organization would fund the vaccine safety research and build centers for adults with autism. I think, you know, that would be there would be an element of natural justice to that, for sure.
At the end of your book, you mentioned Bill Gates and their vaccine foundation. What do you think Bill Gates meant when he said at his TED talk in February 2010 that he would lower global population by 10% with vaccines?
Yes, I think that was a most unfortunate comment, and I can't believe that it was. I think it was more likely to have been a slip of the tongue than anything else.
Let's say we don't give him the benefit of the doubt. What does that mean to you? What I mean, because I have evidence that the Gates family has been behind the eugenics programs and Planned Parenthood and stuff like this. His father was a part of it, and they're continuing the legacy. So let's say we don't even give them the benefit of the doubt for a moment here, and then look at it from the other side of the possibilities of what they could be doing there.
Well, I think if you were going to use vaccination policy as a way of reducing world population, let's say you were using the adverse effects of vaccines to produce a shorter lifespan, increased infant mortality.
What about sterility?
Sterility, all of these things. It would be a very clumsy way of doing it. And it would, because the U.S. is the most intensively vaccinated population in the world, you would be harming potentially, you know, the sort of first world children who are the best educated, the best, whatever. It doesn't really make a great deal of sense. For example, there was a wonderful paper that came out the other day from Gary Goldman, I can't remember, looking at the statistical relationship between numbers of vaccines given to children by the age of one in different countries, 34 different countries around the world, and the infant mortality rate. Taking all factors into consideration, they showed that there was a linear relationship. The more vaccines you got, the higher the infant mortality rate. And this was a striking and counterintuitive observation. You'd think that if vaccines were protecting children, they'd have a lower infant mortality rate. But it was much higher in those who got the most vaccines. It was greatest in the United States of America. So if Mr. Gates is attempting to reduce infant mortality in developing countries by more vaccines, he's going to fail. This statistical analysis shows quite clearly that this will not work. Give them water, give them nutrition, give them sanitation, but don't give them vaccines. So I can't argue in favor of his policy. To use it as a process of eugenics seems to me to be immensely clumsy and cumbersome and highly expensive.
Well, we never said that these people had critical thinking or anything like that. They have a lot of money and an agenda, I think, is really...
And I had this discussion with someone the other day, and I think that at least for now, the humanitarian side of me cannot believe, really can't go there. I can't believe that people would do this in order to cause depopulation.
Is that a fallacy of appeal to believe?
It could be. It could be. It could be.
I suggest you watch a documentary film called MAFA 21, MAAFA 21. And, I think that the people who paid for that film have a bit of their own agenda.
Right.
But if you can filter through their agenda there, I think there's some pretty damning and strong evidence in there of a depopulation program going on right now that's continued since the 1920s and 30s. And Bill Gates' family was behind that as well.
Right. I will go through, and push it.
yeah, through Planned Parenthood. You know, and my ex is actually trying to use the vaccine issue against me right now in a child custody battle that we're in at the moment. And, she tried to say that I was completely against vaccines, and I'm just against, her walking in there and having them have six in one day without spacing them out over several months. And, would you talk about, from your experience, how should children be vaccinated and when, and what is the safest, most efficacious way of handling this situation?
The short answer is that no one knows, because no one has done the studies. But I think your position on the hepatitis B vaccine for your son, for your child, in the first instance was the right one. Show me the evidence. And if you approach the same, this current custody issue with the same approach, look, I'm not anti-vaccine, please show me the evidence. That's an entirely reasonable position to take. Show me the evidence that it's safe to receive all these vaccines.
What I did was I cited in my court declaration the May 4th publication by, who was it, Goldman and someone in the Human and Experimental Toxicology Journal that was talking about how too many vaccines at once is bad for children. So I put that in the declaration.
Yes. Now, I think that, presenting evidence is far and away the strongest argument to remove it from the emotive and to put it in the evidence-based arena. And that puts you in the strongest position and is the most reasonable approach to take as well. I think that there is now a great deal of information out there that can inform parents about the merits of the vaccines in a relatively unbiased way. And I would recommend the National Vaccine Information Center's website. And I would go to the CDC's website as well. I would look at two opposing sides of the argument and make that judgment. There are some very good books out there. Richard Halverson, an author from the UK, a general practitioner who himself runs a vaccine clinic, writing a book called The Truth About Vaccines. There are books from other authors, Dr. Stephanie Cave from Louisiana, on the safer ways to vaccinate your children. So there is a great deal of information out there. Get informed. Insist that your doctors get informed. Please don't be bullied. Remember that your doctors make a lot of their remuneration from hitting vaccine targets, and therefore they're not entirely dispassionate. But go armed with the evidence. And
what about What about Dr. Jay Gordon? What do you think of his work?
I've been following Dr. Gordon. I meet occasionally at various meetings, and I think that he's taken a very considered approach to vaccination and is prepared to listen. I think this is the most important thing. He's prepared to listen to parents' concerns, and he's prepared to act on those concerns on the basis that we are in possession of inadequate data, inadequate knowledge, and until we have that, then we owe it to the parents to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Now, is it making a middle-of-the-road fallacy to say that we should even, you know, because of the thimerosal and the aluminum and things like that, that we're, you know, that it's the middle-of-the-road fallacy to say that it's either, you know, that we should still be doing it or not, rather than waiting until we have the solid facts?
Yes, I mean, this is a great dilemma that presents itself to parents now. There is no reason whatsoever for giving a child a thimerosal-containing vaccine. Absolutely none. You can go there, you can read the product insert in the doctor's surgery, you can insist that you have a vaccine that is free of thimerosal. They exist. There is no reason at all to have it. As far as adjuvants go, you can certainly minimize the risk of being overloaded with aluminum by not having more than one aluminum-containing vaccine at one time and spacing them by months. And again, it is therefore worth checking on the product insert precisely what aluminum-containing adjuvant, if any, is in that vaccine. So there are ways of dealing with this which do not mean that you don't vaccinate. Right. However, in the end, the message must be for the regulators to demand better standards, to investigate safer ways of doing it. And they owe that to the public, because if they don't do it, then we will lose public confidence in vaccine policy across the board, and they only have themselves to blame.
Do aluminum and mercury pass directly through the blood-brain barrier?
It's a good question. I'm not an expert on that particular matter. So I believe that they can. I think that ethyl mercury is a fat-soluble compound, an organic compound that can get through the blood-brain barrier. But again, it's not my field of expertise, so I will defer to someone else on that.
And then what were the other vaccines that you said? You said hepatitis B that you wouldn't give until at least 14 to 16, and if they were at risk. And then we discussed the MMR. What other vaccines might you consider unsafe?
Well, again, it's a huge question, because the adequacy of the safety studies on various vaccines is so poor. And then if you just take the human papillomavirus, the so-called cervical cancer vaccine. The vaccine was fast-tracked, the safety studies were inadequate, and the problems that are arising now with that vaccine, I see the first legal cases in France have started, and a large number of girls appear to have been harmed by that vaccine. It was rushed through, the safety studies weren't done. And you could apply the same kind of observations to a great number of vaccines. They don't have to go through the same rigorous safety testing as drugs do, for example, which is somewhat bizarre because they're being given to healthy people. Therefore, you would imagine that the standards applied to them would be even greater, but that's not the case. So the more I read, the more concerns I have.
What is the single most important concept or lesson that you would like listeners to take away from this interview?
Two things. One is a general comment, and that is, we must have a safety-first vaccine policy. It must be driven by a safety-first agenda. Not profit, not efficacy, not coverage, but safety-first. That's number one. Number two is for parents at the individual level, and that is to trust your instincts. Maternal instinct in particular has served us very well. We would not be here on this earth without it. And therefore, mothers, parents must trust their instinct. They know when their children are well, they know when they're ill, and they must listen to those inner feelings, because that's what doctors rely upon in the patient-doctor interaction when determining what is going wrong and how to put it right. So please trust your instincts.
And please give out the titles of your book or books and website and any other information such as contact that you would like people to have.
Certainly. The first book, my experience in the UK and the General Medical Council inquiry, is called Callous Disregard, Autism and Vaccines, the Truth Behind a Tragedy. And if you go to the website callous-disregard.com, then you can purchase that book. It's also available at Amazon. And the second book that is hopefully coming out in the fall is called Hoping for Perpetual Sunshine. And it's about the war waged on the autistic child and the legacy of Baron von Munchausen. And when you read the book, you'll understand why the title, Hoping for Perpetual Sunshine. It'll all make sense. So those are the two books so far. And hopefully there will be more to come.
And I look forward to reading that, and maybe we'll have you back on once we've gotten that read.
That's wonderful.
Thank you so much, Andrew. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to seeing more of your work, and I hope that you make major gains in the coming years in gaining back your integrity and helping to save so many children as you've done in your book, showing that your integrity is strong against those who are attacking you.
Thank you very much, Ian. Appreciate it.